This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ضَرَّاءَ مَسَّتْهُ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, The evils are gone away from me. Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour. Iran's leader officially endorses Ebrahim Raisi as the 8th president of the Islamic Republic. China's Wuhan will test its entire population for COVID-19 after the city where the coronavirus first emerged reported its first local infections in more than a year. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Islamic Revolution leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has endorsed Ebrahim Raisi as the country's new president in a ceremony in Tehran. In a mandate read out during the ceremony, the leader said the new president should work to remove obstacles to production and strengthen the national currency. Later, Ayatollah Khamenei thanked people for the turnout in the June presidential election, despite enemies' propaganda to persuade them to sanction the vote. The leader called on the new president to stay true to his election pledges, including efforts to address economic problems and fight corruption. Ayatollah Khamenei also said the new president should move quickly to form his cabinet. The leader added that there are many problems to address, but the government can well overcome them by tapping into Iran's vast national potential. Iran's new president, Ebrahim Raisi, has vowed to rebuild public trust and bridge the gap between the government and the people during his tenure.
What has caused the most problems, in addition to the harm inflicted to people's livelihoods and businesses, is the damage to public trust. People sought a government to repair this damage, to restore their trust and narrow the gap with the government. A good relationship between the government and people can resolve problems.
Raisi made the comments after he was confirmed as Iran's 8th president. He said the Iranian nation demanded change, justice, and an end to corruption through their vote in the June 18 presidential election. He added that change is necessary and inevitable, and that his government plans to make it happen. Raisi called on the elites, officials, and people to play their part and help bring about that change. The 61-year-old president also noted that he would certainly try to get U.S. sanctions removed, but would not tie people's livelihoods and the economy to that aim. The Lebanese prime minister designate says the task of forming a new government will take much longer than what he had expected. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's see what our guests had to say. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Philippines' Prime Minister-designate says that the pace towards the formation of a new government is slower than what he had expected.
Frankly, with regard to the government, I was hoping the pace would be faster. It's going a bit slow. We wanted to form a government and announce it to the Lebanese people before August the 4th. August the 4th is a disaster that fell upon Lebanon and all the Lebanese people.
Najib Mikati made the remarks following a meeting with President Bashar Aoun. He also said that his efforts to form a new cabinet will not be open-ended. Mikati was tasked with forming a government after former Premier Saad al-Hariri failed to muster support despite months of efforts. Lebanon has been run by a caretaker administration since a huge blast devastated Beirut's port in last August. The Mediterranean nation has been struggling with a crippling financial crisis that has pushed half the country's population into poverty. The ongoing political deadlock has further worsened Lebanon's already faltering economy. Correspondent Mariam Saleh joins us from Beirut to give us the latest, and we also have Elijah McNair, who's a journalist and political analyst, joining us from Brussels. Okay, Mariam, over to you. Tell us why Najib Mikati, in a statement just hours ago, said that the formation of a cabinet is slower than what he had expected.
Well, we know that these talks take time usually. We never have a government that is formed in Lebanon that takes less than a month. He was hoping for less time, but here we're just talking about a week. He was hoping for something. I think that this is being the result of perhaps more pushing from the foreign sides like France and so on. They're pushing for a government before the 4th of August, before the international conference that will be held for the sake of Lebanon. That is almost impossible because you have several details that need to be agreed upon. And we have issues that now seem to be a little bit more flexible than before. What they're trying to agree on specifically, Prime Minister Designate and President Michel Aoun, is how the cabinet will be distributed. And we're talking here about confessional distribution. And that is an issue that has been a tradition inside Lebanon, although the Constitution stipulates that we end this sectarian system. However, this continues because there are certain groups that don't want to be considered minorities or don't want to lose their power in the government. So basically what they've agreed on is that we have the heavyweight ministries will be given to the bigger sects. You have, for example, five ministers for the bigger sects like the Maronite Christians, the Sunni Muslims, the Sunni Shiites. And then you have these smaller groups like the Armenians and Druze. They take less number of ministers. We also have an issue which is very significant, is that we always had specific ministries given to specific sects. Like, for example, you had the interior ministry that was always given to the Sunni Muslims. And that is something that President Michel Aoun has been opposing. But these are some details that they could probably overcome, but it's not very clear. It's always 50% chance that you don't see a government and you see Mikati resigning, and that could be possible, but they're giving a chance. They're going to meet again on Thursday. All of this comes in light of the fact that Lebanon's ready to commemorate the first anniversary of the most catastrophic event in Lebanon, we can say the 4th of August explosion.
So you got all these challenges, Elijah Magnier, obviously, that Najib Mikati is facing. What do you think are the chances that Mikati is approaching this in a form and manner that does not have that sense of urgency that we see Lebanon needs to have? And what are the chances of Mikati, I mean, he's done it before, perhaps coming up short in whatever respects and then calling it quits?
Thank you for having me. I think the chances of Mikati to resign are very high. The main problem today is the interior ministry. President Michel Aoun is insisting on giving the interior ministry to the Maronite Christians because there are the elections, the parliamentary election in the spring 2022. And Mikati is insisting, like his predecessor, Prime Minister Hariri, to give the interior ministry to the Sunni rather than the Maronite. And President Aoun is saying, as the Shia speaker, Nabi Birri, is insisting in having the finance ministry for the Shia, therefore, it is up to him also to insist on the interior ministry. And because President Aoun will come to term in office, and because his brother-in-law, his son-in-law, sorry, former Minister Gibran Basile, wants to be part of the political arena and wants to secure himself, perhaps as a new president of Lebanon, he wants to be able to have a strong leverage on the interior ministry. This is the main debate that's happening today between the Sunni prime minister and the Christian president. And they're not going to come to a term, they're not going to agree. It's very obvious that the president is insisting on his position and the prime minister is insisting because he also wants to have enough support for his group in the forthcoming parliamentary elections. And this is not going to be resolved, no matter how the intervention from the European community or the Americans on Lebanon, it is an internal matter between the Sunni and the Christian, and each one wants the same position and they're not ready to let go. And this is we are in Lebanon in a kind of impasse and going nowhere. And the previous prime minister needed 8 to 9 months and offered his resignation because he didn't find a solution for this dilemma. And I don't think Najib Mikati would manage to do so.
Elijah Magnier, thank you so much for your contribution. Journalist and political analyst from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Welcome back. The Chinese city of Wuhan, where COVID-19 emerged for the first time, will test its entire population as the virus returns there. Authorities are saying that all 11 million residents will swiftly be tested. On Monday, the city logged 7 COVID infections among migrant workers. They were the first local cases that were identified in more than a year after Wuhan brought its outbreak under control. Other Chinese cities have also rolled out mass testing as an outbreak of the Delta variant quickly spreads. People in affected areas have been confined to their homes also. On Tuesday, China reported 61 domestic infections. The number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the U.S. has surpassed the grim milestone of 35 million. According to Johns Hopkins University tally, more than 613,000 people have also died from the disease. California has become the first state to top 4 million cases. Yemen's armed forces backed by local tribes have made new gains in the oil-rich province of Ma'arib. The Yemeni army has advanced in from several directions, capturing strategic hilltops from the capital city of Ma'arib. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more.
New advances have been made by Yemen's armed forces backed by local tribes toward the oil-rich province of Ma'arib to liberate it from the Saudi-backed forces. The recent advances were made in conjunction with a major victory of the Yemeni army against the Saudi-backed militant groups in Al-Baida province.
Ma'arib is the center of the mobilization of the enemy forces, and therefore the Saudi-led coalition tried to distract the Yemeni army by opening other fronts, as happened in Al-Baida. But the Yemeni army is fully aware of all the evasions of the enemies. Ma'arib is now surrounded from all sides, and we control all the mountainous heights and strategic points overlooking Ma'arib. There is a small area in Bayhan. If the Yemeni army takes control of, supplies will be completely cut off to the enemy.
Military experts said the Yemeni army attacked the Saudi-backed forces in the Baqatha area and Rahaba Directorate of southern Ma'arib, as well as Al-Bilq al-Qibli Mountains overlooking the western neighborhoods of the city of Ma'arib. The Yemeni army, the experts said, is now surrounding the city from all sides.
Our forces managed to control the most important mountains and hills in Ma'arib, and the consecutive victories in Al-Baida gave our forces an advantage in encircling Ma'arib and besieging it from all sides. We have been able to liberate most of the southern and western regions. The battle is settled in favor of the Yemeni army, and the enemy is in a dire state.
For many months now, the Yemeni army has intensified its operations to take control of strategic Ma'arib province. Observers say Yemen's army has made remarkable advances against the Saudi-backed forces, meaning that Saudi Arabia is up to lose its last stronghold in northern Yemen.
Yemenis say their army will eventually liberate Ma'arib from the Saudi-backed forces and flip the table over Saudi Arabia and its allies. They believe that this is the only way to push Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege and accept a political solution. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Lebanese Prime Minister designate says that the pace towards the formation of a new government is slower than what he had expected.
Frankly, with regard to the government, I was hoping the pace would be faster. It's going a bit slow. We wanted to form a government and announce it to the Lebanese people before August the 4th. August the 4th is a disaster that fell upon Lebanon and all the Lebanese people.
Najib Mikati made the remarks following a meeting with President Bashar Aoun. He also said that his efforts to form a new cabinet will not be open-ended. Mikati was tasked with forming a government after the former premier, Saad al-Hariri, failed to muster support despite months of efforts. Lebanon has been run by a caretaker administration since a huge blast devastated Beirut's port in last August. The Mediterranean nation has been struggling with a crippling financial crisis that has pushed half the country's population into poverty. The ongoing political deadlock has further worsened Lebanon's already faltering economy. Malaysia's opposition lawmakers, angry over the postponement of a parliament session, have marched toward the legislative building to demand the resignation of Prime Minister Muhyiddin Yassin. The lawmakers, who chanted slogans against Muhyiddin, were stopped by police. The opposition leader, Anwar Ibrahim, delivered a speech accusing the premier of acting against the constitution. The parliament convened last week following months-long suspension due to a virus state of emergency, but its final session on Monday was postponed with a notice citing the detection of several COVID cases among attendees. The opposition, however, claims that it was a politically motivated move to dodge a no-confidence vote. Muhyiddin is at the heart of controversy since the king rebuked his government for misleading parliament over coronavirus laws. Public anger against the government's pandemic response has also led to protests calling for the premier to quit. The Cuban ambassador to the Vienna-based international organization, Marlon Redondo, has accused the U.S. of engaging in a propaganda campaign to destabilize her country.
Previous weeks, it was developed a manipulation and communication campaign financed by the U.S. with the objective of inciting, encouraging people to go out to the streets with the objective of encouraging instability in the country. And they took the opportunity, the advantage of the real hard situation that Cuba is living right now due to the pandemic, due to the reinforcement of the blockade with the application of more than 240 measures during the Trump administration. And they took that that advantage to do their campaign. And during those weeks, they were inciting to violence. They were calling for vandalism acts.
Redondo explained how the current U.S. administration is advancing his predecessor's disinformation campaign against Cuba over recent protests there. Redondo blamed Washington for fueling the unrest in the Caribbean nation. Last month, the U.S. imposed new sanctions against Cuba, citing alleged human rights abuses and the detention of protesters. Cuban officials said that Washington's arbitrary measures were aimed at justifying its economic blockade against their country. Cuba has witnessed protests recently over an ongoing economic crisis. Havana blames Washington's decades-long embargo and sanctions for the country's financial downturn. Israel's Supreme Court is set to rule on the planned eviction of Palestinians from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied Al-Quds. Monday's verdict could lead to forcible removal of Palestinians from their ancestral homes to make way for the regime to build settler units. The ruling was delayed after the Attorney General requested more time to study the case in May. The Israeli plan had sparked anger and protests, which were met with a crackdown by regime forces, leaving hundreds of Palestinians injured. Since May clashes, Sheikh Jarrah has been blockaded by Israeli troops, which locals say amounts to a siege. The case has also captured global attention, with international rights groups accusing Israel of plotting to grab more land in the occupied territories to hand them over to settlers. And that is for World News. Stay with us. It's bye-bye for now.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight. Italy and France are introducing Europe's toughest vaccine pass regimes for normal social activities like dining indoors at restaurants, visiting museums and attending sporting events. The article you're about to hear has been written by the London Evening Standard journalist Leah Sinclair. The piece is titled, Italy and France Introduce Europe's Toughest Vaccine Pass Regimes as protests break out in Paris. Italy and France are introducing Europe's toughest vaccine pass regimes for normal social activities like dining indoors at restaurants, visiting museums, and attending sporting events. Leaders in both countries see the vaccination cards, dubbed the Green Pass in Italy and the Health Pass in France, as needed to boost vaccination rates and persuade the undecided to get vaccinated. The French Health Pass is required at movie theaters, museums, and tourist sites, and comes into effect for restaurants and trains on 9th of August. To get it, people must be double jabbed, have a recent negative test, or proof they recently recovered from COVID-19. For Italy, just one vaccine dose is required to get the pass, and it applies to outdoor dining, cinemas, stadiums, museums, and other gathering places from 6th of August. Since the introduction of the passes, vaccine uptake seems to have increased in both countries. Vaccine demand in Italy increased as much as 200% in some regions since the government announced the Green Pass, according to the country's Special Commissioner for Vaccinations. Meanwhile, nearly 5 million people received the first dose of the vaccine in France, and more than 6 million got a second dose in the 2 weeks after President Emmanuel Macron announced that the virus passes would be expanded to restaurants and other public venues. However, there are those who are concerned about the passes and claim it is a violation of civil liberties. Around 80,000 people protested against the certification in cities across Italy last weekend, while thousands of people took to the streets of Paris, France, this weekend. Many say vaccine pass requirements could potentially breed inequality that will further divide society. We're creating a segregated society, and I think it is unbelievable to be doing this in the country of human rights, and a teacher who was demonstrating in Paris told the Reuters news agency. So I took to the streets. I have never protested before in my life. I think our freedom is in danger. Haga Amour, a 37-year-old nurse, said she resigned from her job, accusing the government of using a form of blackmail. "I think that we mustn't be told what to do," she told the Associated Press. "And now suddenly we're told that if we don't get vaccinated, it is our fault that people are contaminated. I think it is sickening." Meanwhile, in Italy, quarantine rules have been extended for British tourists for another month. All Britons must show a negative COVID test result, quarantine for 5 days, and test again at the end of their isolation period in order to enter Italy. The country reported 6,171 infections and 19 deaths on Thursday, 29th of July, up from 5,696 infections and 15 deaths on Wednesday, according to the Italian Health Ministry. Also, Greece is considering new rules and restrictions in a blow to British holidaymakers. Greek Deputy Civil Protection Minister Nikos Hardalias said Mykonos and Ios were one step away from authorities imposing restrictions amid the rise in COVID cases. He also said the government was concerned about rising COVID cases in Zante, Tinos, Lefkada, Santorini, Paros, and Rhodes. All but essential travel has been discouraged to and from the country's South Aegean islands after a surge in transmissions.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ministry.
Another unilateral move by the United States once more promises to affect lives of people around the world for the worse, this time in terms of internet freedom. In an expected move on Tuesday, June 22nd, the U.S. Justice Department seized 36 websites with links to the Islamic Republic of Iran and its regional allies for engaging in, quote, disinformation campaigns and malign influence operations, unquote. The move initially arose suspicions of a hack since a disclaimer that said this website has been seized accompanied an Arabic text as the one you can still see on PressTV.com. While State Department spokesman Ned Price refused to comment. The Empire's Justice Department eventually said three of the seized domains belonged to the Iraqi group Kata'ab Hezbollah, while the rest, including Yemeni, Palestinian, and Bahraini outlets in English and Arabic, were supported by the Iranian Islamic Radio and Television Union. The seized websites obviously belonged to outlets of the allied resistance communities, better known as the Resistance Axis, that Iran supports across the region to counter the influence of the U.S. and regional rivals like Israel and Saudi Arabia. Try to keep a straight face here. The U.S. blacklisted us with designations related to terrorism. I kid you not. The mother of all terrorism, also known as the Empire, said that the American companies are not allowed to provide us with .com and .net domains without special authorization from the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC. U.S. fascist officials can choose to label it however they wish, yet they will never be able to change the fact that this seizure is a clear example of a systematic effort to distort freedom of speech on a global level and silence independent voices in media, which gives us and everyone included in the seizure the full right to pursue the issue through legal channels. While the U.S. may have given itself the ability to exert influence over vast sections of the internet, its actions will for sure have far-reaching ramifications beyond its control. Those unilateral harassment actions will only give credence to arguments of U.S. interference and censoring due to fear of being further exposed by native media in nations they continue to sanction like Iran, occupy like Iraq, and bomb like Yemen. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, Amar Osman. More than 30 web domains linked to the Axis of Resistance, one of which is Press TV, were blatantly seized by U.S. agencies last week. The U.S. seized sites operated inside Iran, Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon, as well as social media channels affiliated with the Iraqi resistance, the PMU. The seizures come as the Biden administration is in the midst of negotiations over Tehran's nuclear program and follow the election of a new president who has been criticized by Washington for being a staunch detractor of its imperial foreign policy. Now, the Iranian government condemned this act of censorship as unlawful and part of an influence campaign against the Islamic Republic of Iran. To discuss this issue with us in Beirut is Hadi Shatila, founder of iBreathe Media and a tech expert. Thank you very much for being with us, Hadi. Now, visitors of the affected websites by the seizure, by the U.S. Seizure, were greeted with a banner that says that the domain name has been seized by the U.S. government as part of, I quote, enforcement action taken by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Bureau of Industry and Security. Now, if you want to define and maybe phrase this, just put it into words, how would you do that?
First of all, we need to understand one thing, which is that what happened was that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has seized the DNS side of the website, not the actual site. So it's what tells the when a person browses for a site, he types a name. The DNS service is what tells the browser that this name belongs to this IP address. This link is what the Federal Bureau of Investigation has seized. That's basically what happened in the first part.
So that would you putting it into actual words, but that actual seizure from a tech point of view, how much time would have that have taken, and what would the tools be that they used to do that?
Since they have access to the actual DNS service, from a local company inside the U.S., which runs these DNS addresses, they can do it easily. With one court order, they can directly seize control on anything which is considered on U.S. soil.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you an Immigration and Customs Enforcement spokeswoman had declared, when that happened before, it declared that this act of... we can call it internet fascism by the U.S., was performed that by the U.S. government because it has a right to seize the .com, .net, and .org domain names simply because the companies have the contracts to administer them are based on U.S. soil. If that is the case, wouldn't such actions urge people to move away from these domain names to try and at least protect their work?
Well, basically, they should the people should start to understand that since there is no actual real internet governance, which is in unbiased hands, they should know that whenever they buy any of these domains, they are susceptible to being seized by the U.S. government. Knowing that, if you want to go to the legal side of it, the U.S. should only be enforcing whatever ends with a .us. So it might be .com, then .us. Or, like, for example, in Lebanon, .com.lb, and whatever other country, .me, for example. It depends on which country. So each country can have access to its own domains if it was the unbiased way to achieve such a thing. But sadly, what's happening is that they have control over all the .com, the .net, even the .org, since the companies that run these domains are on American soil, and VeriSign, which is the company that runs the .com and .net, is very very closely tied to the system.
You mentioned VeriSign, Hadi, and it's a U.S.-based internet backbone company that has the contract to manage the coveted.com and other generic top-level domains, the ones that you just mentioned, and it has a very cozy relationship, and I mean cozy, that's described by the U.S. media, not by me, with the federal government, with the FBI, and has long had a contract from the U.S. government to help manage the internet's root file, which is the key to having a unified internet name system. What would now stop other international corporation for assigned names and numbers from following suit of unleashing a global government crackdown on domain names that simply do not abide by Western values or Western narratives, or just simply are not liked by the US, the UK, or any other Western regime?
Again, sadly, we are at a point where nothing can stop such seizures happening in anywhere in the world, since they have ultimate access to all these things. There's the ICANN, ICANN. They were under American control for some time, and then they released that control, and they started making 13 multiple organizations governing each part of the world. They are non-governmental organization. They don't get paid by any government. And they are one step towards global internet governance, trying to make internet unbiased location. But still, the U.S. hasn't released its hand over these names. So we get to a loop where we are susceptible to have our domains seized at any moment just by being connected to any ideology or any political stance which is maybe anti-US or anti-West, or maybe not doesn't go well with US comprehension of things.
Or simply, if you're going to compete with the US, we did see that happening to a lot of also Chinese websites where they were seized, they were put down. But I had a technical question concerning something that you mentioned about the .com.lb, for example. Is that more secure from the .com by itself? If I'm going to go with the .com.ir instead of just .com, should that be more safe than just going with the domain name .ir?
Your own country's domain, for example, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, there's the .ir, which is governed by Iranian law. It has nothing to do with American governance over the internet. So, of course, it's much safer to invest in your own domain. And maybe if you want, you can link a .com to it for SEO purposes, which later on might have other issues. But that's another tactical path.
So you mean that only having a .ir might make it hard to find it on a search engine?
Yes, true. Because the crawlers work in a different way, and also the search engine itself might be biased. It might push things which aren't actually relevant.
Hello, Google.
Exactly.
Well, many outside the United States, like China, Russia, India, they distrust this U.S. cozy tech companies, especially with the big tech companies, the social media ones, and have been vocal about wanting to see control being shared all across the world, which is just fair, at least to say it's fair, of the internet's naming system. They want to see it turned over to an organization such as the International Telecommunications Union, an affiliate of the United Nations. Now, look, once you say UN, I, for one, as a citizen of West Asia, I am a bit panicking once I hear the word UN. Why? Because it is an international body, but it's a biased body.
True.
So what are we actually doing here?
Maybe this makes it less susceptible to U.S. seizure, but in the end it will be biased. But since it presents itself as an unbiased organization, it gives us a range of movement to work with such institutes.
So it might actually protect domain names, or might just get them on board a certain committee that would have to study if that domain name
exactly.
is used or not.
It gets them maybe on the side where instead of having, like, for example, you sleep and then you wake up with 30 plus websites being seized, you'll wake up with a warning, and then things will start to take a bit of meetings from here, discussions there, debates here, until they get to a certain...
But wouldn't that just threaten freedom of speech?
At the end of the day,
a form of censorship.
Exactly. That's what's happening.
Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you very much, Hadi Shatila, founder of
iBreathe
Media, for explaining to us what actually happened when the U.S. blatantly decided to take over our websites and the websites of our sister channels as well. Thank you very much for being with us. It was great content from you, Hadi. And please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about what is going on in the occupied West Bank.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
C seems that death in Palestinian authority custody no longer differs than that of the Israeli occupation's use of ruthless excessive force against Palestinians during incarceration, and that's being said sadly. An outspoken critic of the Palestinian Authority who intended to run in the parliamentary elections before they were actually canceled earlier this May died during his arrest in Hebron by Palestinian Authority forces on Thursday. Nizar Banat, 44 years old, was a harsh critic of the Palestinian Authority, which governs part of the Israeli-occupied West Bank, and called on Western nations to cut off aid to it because of its growing authoritarianism and human rights violations. More in this following report.
Hundreds of Palestinian natives continue to gather on a daily basis in the city of Ramallah to protest over the death of activist Nizar Banat after being dragged by excessive force out of his home on Thursday, June 24th at 3:30 a.m. in the morning by the Palestinian Authority security forces. Angry demonstrators gathered in the city of Ramallah, the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority, to chant slogans against President Mahmoud Abbas 2 days after Abbas's forces arrested and killed activist Nizar Banat. They carried Palestinian flags, photos of Banat, and signs demanding the fall of the regime. Protests were also held in Hebron and El Bireh. Palestinian security forces then launched a heavy barrage of tear gas into the crowd of hundreds in Ramallah and attacked protesters and several journalists. Earlier, plainclothes security forces spread out among protesters as they marched from the center of Ramallah towards the presidential offices and closed off the intersection leading to the area, forcing shops to close. One video from the protest showed security forces in plain clothes dragging a protester across the road as they simultaneously beat him.
القيادة الفلسطينية التقليدية هذه لحكم الضفة الغربية اليوم طول عمرها هيك بتتاجر بكل شيء.
But who is Banat and why is his death, which some is now dubbing as an assassination, so significant? The prominent Palestinian political activist and an advocate of free speech was known for his outspoken videos on social media criticizing the Palestinian Authority for its corruption, as well as its shameful security coordination with the Israeli occupation forces in the occupied West Bank. A former member of the Farah movement himself, the de facto ruling party of the Palestinian Authority, Banat had been campaigning as a candidate for legislative elections on the Freedom and Dignity list. The elections initially scheduled for May were postponed by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in April. While Abbas cited the voting rights of Palestinians living in occupied East Al-Quds as a reason to push back the elections, critics have accused him of seeking excuses to avoid a vote due to his party's unpopularity. Banat was well known for his extensive knowledge of Palestinian political and social history, often recalling anecdotes about the Palestinian Liberation Organization PLO in the 1970s or the British Mandate of Palestine before 1948 in order to make his point. In May, bullets, stun grenades, and tear gas were fired at the Banat family home while his wife and children were inside. Banat accused ruling party Fatah of being behind the attack and called on the European Union to cut its financial aid to the Palestinian Authority. Banat had also accused the Palestinian Authority of perpetrating torture on political dissidents detained in its prisons. Hence, his sudden death while in the hands of the Palestinian Authority sparked outrage and dismay in the Palestinian streets, which many believe has triggered the inevitable downfall of the Palestinian Authority.
So with us to discuss this issue is Mr. Ali Murad, who's a political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ali. Now, just like that, a brief statement was given by the Hebron Governorate saying that Nizar Banat's health deteriorated while he was in custody when Palestinian forces arrested him from his house earlier on Thursday, and that he was taken to a hospital where he was pronounced dead. This is definitely not the first case where we see a detainee dying while in custody of the Palestinian Authority security forces. However, this man was known to have faced direct threats from members of the Palestinian Authority. How come this matter escalated to a point that whoever arrested him ended up just murdering him?
Thank you for hosting me. Of course, martyr Nizar Banat was threatened nearly on a daily basis. He had told his friends and his family that he is receiving death threats weeks before the assassination took place. Nizar's problem is that he was outspoken. He never, ever was able to louder his voice when talking about the corruption of the Palestinian Authority and all the security apparatus that Mahmoud Abbas rules the West Bank using it. So Nizar Banat, I think, was the man who had the bravery and all the strength that many others lack. He used his voice to speak. He never held a gun to shoot at the security forces or any member of the Palestinian Authority. All he had his voice, his bravery, talking about what is wrong, the corruption, the security coordination with the Zionist enemy that Mahmoud Abbas is insisting on keeping. So I think other circumstances maybe has led to the assassination of Nizar, because after the battle of the Al-Quds sword, the Palestinian Authority sensed that the popularity, its popularity is going down. So
Mr. Ali, before I even contacted you to come and be our guest speaker, I spoke with four different Palestinian natives living in the West Bank who canceled right after actually saying, yes, we'd be happy to talk about Nizar, but they canceled because they were afraid that they would be incarcerated exactly. themselves. So it's a real police state there.
Exactly.
And as you said, Nizar didn't even have a weapon to defend himself, because weapons are also not allowed because of the coordination, the security coordination with Israel. But in early May, he had gunmen firing bullets, tear exactly. gas, grenade, stun grenades at his house while his wife and his children were inside the house. He blamed the attack on Mahmoud Abbas himself and the Fatah party. Now, is there something that could have been done to avert them attacking his house again, or is it just too complicated to talk about it as if it's something that should not happen? Because we don't really have a lot of information coming out of the West Bank.
Exactly. But we have to know something before to answer this, because if you take a look at the history of the relation between Nizar and the security apparatus of Abu Mazen, you'll find out that he was taken into as a detainee for like 10 times or 15 times before. He was beaten. He was at several times his bones were crushed, and still Nizar remained the same. In other ways, Nizar was sending a message that no matter how violent you were in dealing with me, in trying to oppress me, in trying to silence me, I will not be silent. I will remain speaking. He went to run for elections, the elections that Mahmoud Abbas canceled during the last month.
In May, yeah.
Yes. So all the voices that declared that they are against the way that Mahmoud Abbas is ruling regarding the elections and regarding the corruption with the coronavirus vaccines, also with all the security coordination with the Zionist entity.
The goal of the coordination with the Israeli entity, is it he learned from them how to suppress his own people?
Actually, he is getting paid to prevent resistance. This is the main role of the Palestinian Authority. The Oslo Accords made it clear that any authority that the Palestinian Authority to rule in the West Bank, it has to do this to prevent any act of resistance. Now I believe he Mahmoud Abbas moved into another step by silencing all the voices. Now we are not talking about taking guns or putting resistance activists inside jail. We are talking about oppression. Oppression that is not serving. It's serving the goal of a dictatorship. We are talking about a dictator now. Mahmoud Abbas has turned himself into a dictator. He is no different than other dictators.
What are the options left for the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank to try and at least fix the situation? We don't want Palestinians fighting one another, but what options do they have?
Because the Palestinian Authority is acting as an agent of the enemy, it left no choice for the Palestinians, for the majority of the Palestinians who want to resist the occupation. They want to liberate their lands. So we are seeing now, since the assassination of Nizar, there are protests taking place in more than one city and in all in many villages in the West Bank.
It's on a daily basis. It's
yes.
not ending.
I think this is the available choice now. Maybe there has to be done, something has to be done inside the Fatah movement, because there are free people, there are real patriots in the Fatah movement. They have to rebel against their leadership. They have to change this leadership, because in the era of victories, with the victory that the resistance
achieved last month,
the same way that Mahmoud Abbas is still ruling is outdated. I believe that
definitely incompatible. Definitely, it's something to really think about and give way for the Palestinians to decide for themselves. Obviously, but we hope the best for all our Palestinian brothers in the face of the occupation. Thank you very much, Ali Murad, political commentator, for joining us from Beirut to talk about the assassination of Nizar Banat, the Palestinian activist, sadly at the hands of Palestinian Authority security forces. Thank you very much for being with us. And please stay tuned. Next week, we have more for you on the Mideast Stream.
In the limelight. A letter from the legal charity Bail for Immigration Detainees to head of UK's immigration enforcement, dated 29th of July, raises concerns over the Home Office's failure to acknowledge received or settled status applications in cases where it wants to deport EU citizens. We're prepared for you an article written by Mark Townsend under the heading EU citizens who applied to stay in Britain facing threat of deportation. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. European citizens who have applied for settled status are being detained and threatened with deportation, development that contradicts assurances from UK ministers and appears to contravene the Brexit withdrawal agreement. The Home Office has served European Union nationals with removal directions, even though they could prove they had applied for settled status, which should protect their rights to remain in the United Kingdom. Ministers have repeatedly promised that anyone who had applied by 30th of June deadline would have their existing rights protected while their case was being heard. The apparent failure to honour the agreement has prompted accusations of either administrative incompetence by the Home Office officials or a willful attempt to deport as many European Union nationals as possible on the assumption they're easier to remove, for instance, than asylum seekers. A letter from the legal charity Bail for Immigration Detainees to the head of the Immigration Enforcement, dated 29th of July, raises concerns over the Home Office's failure to acknowledge received or settled status applications in cases where it wants to deport European Union citizens. Bail for Immigration Detainees says that unless a meaningful response is received from the Home Office in recent days, it will make an official complaint to the European Commission. Lawyers argue it marks an important battle to protect the rights of European Union nationals following Brexit. They warn that the failure to acknowledge applications could potentially affect thousands of individuals. Friday, 30th of July, an EU citizen whom the Home Office wanted to deport and who had been detained in an immigration removal centre secured their release on bail after a judge accepted that they could not be removed because they had made an European Union settlement scheme application. Even so, the Home Office still contested their release and offered no apology or explanation why it had earlier argued there was no evidence of the application at a previous hearing and therefore could deport them. Speaking shortly after being released, the European Union national